tune into this progressive, important Cuba in Focus production. That's Friday, September 1st, 7 a.m., a talk with Cuba's top representatives to the United Nations. Don't miss it.
Trump's policies treat working people as a bottom line rather than human beings. The unions as a threat and rising wages as a problem rather than the foundation of the country's prosperity. His strategy to keep jobs in America relies on busting unions, keeping wages down, deregulating everything in sight, and cutting taxes for the wealthy. So on Labor Day, we'll build bridges amongst the workers to unite, raise their wages, and tell it like it is. Trump's declared a war on the workers, and it's time to fight back. Tune into our Building Bridges Labor Day special Monday, September 4th, 6 to 10 p.m. Produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
And you are listening to radio station WBAI in New York, where so much is going on over these airwaves. Wow. Well, it's 8 o'clock now, and what's going to be going over these airwaves at this time is Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. Only live on for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood.
And a very, very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening. Joined tonight by Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Alex.
Good evening.
And Kyle.
Hey, everyone. How's it going?
Welcome back, Kyle. You've been away for a few weeks.
I have been away for a couple weeks.
Been traveling, huh?
Yeah, really exploring, and it was okay. I was here in spirit.
That's true. So was I. Actually, I was traveling, too. You know what? I was traveling with you.
That's
now
right.
It's all coming back to me. Okay.
No, actually sounds familiar.
Yeah, we were both on the road at the same time. That's okay. That explains a lot. I want to thank you guys for holding down the fort while we were away, Rob and
Alex
and Voltaire, who's not here right now, but and, of course, our listeners. It's good to be back. Yeah, we basically took a round-the-country trip. We started in Seattle and then took a train down to the Bay Area, took another train down to Los Angeles, took another train over to New Orleans, rented a car, drove up to Tennessee to see the eclipse, took the car back to New Orleans and got another train up to Chicago, and then got another train from Chicago to Washington, D.C. to New York.
Did you have to change to Jamaica?
I am so sick of trains, I can't even begin to describe it.
Yes, we did change it to Jamaica.
Okay.
Yeah, we had to do that, of course. You got to change it to Jamaica. I mean,
it was a specific, yeah, it was either that or Huntington, right?
But, you know, there are so many really, really cool people in this country, I have to say. We met a lot of them. It's just something we tend to forget a lot of times. Yeah, not in the hallways of BAI, though. We always have fun there. But it's just, you go to certain parts of the world, certain parts of the country, and you feel trepidation. And then you go there and you realize that there's so much that we have in common, so much that we can share and benefit from if we just talk and hang out and do fun things. So we need to do more of that.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Last week, I think it was, you mentioned that you were in the Bay Area, and you said, I believe it was that Oakland was one of your new favorite places. Was that right? Did I get that wrong? If I'm right about that, well, I would love for you to explain that.
Okay. No, Oakland is definitely one of my favorite places now. We spent some time there. Turns out there's this place called Jack London, was it Square? Or?
Jack London Square, yeah.
Okay. I'm not really sure what Jack London's relationship to Oakland. I guess he lived there or something. He wrote about the Great North, you know,
yeah,
sled dogs and things like that.
A writer, I believe. Yeah,
yeah, not many. He was a writer. Not many. Donald Trump might be calling him, though. Who knows? There was just this part of Oakland that we literally got off the train, and the train goes down the street. It goes down the Amtrak train and the freight trains. They all go down an actual street that cars also drive on. It's the most incredible thing to see. So I fell in love with that right away. But just the mood of the town was just kind of down to earth, rebellious, and progressive. And I really like that.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting that. It's been true for a number of years, actually, in Oakland. I do know that. But I hadn't given it a chance. You know, I assume Berkeley was the cool place to be, which it's also cool. But I think Oakland is kind of surpassing it now.
Yeah, there was definitely less foot traffic and attractions, and more of your sort of everyday. Well, there's a distribution for all kinds of fresh fruit and vegetable mm-hmm. Produce distribution, and all this like activity of like hard work and grittiness. We really like these sort of off the beaten path. Industrial areas.
And we found a bunch of them just by wandering around, looking up where the cool coffee place is to go, and then where the cool neighborhoods are, such as East Nashville. All right, East Nashville is a really cool place to hang out, Germantown. Mm-hmm. We went to a place in Tennessee called Franklin, which has this incredible mall that, how would you describe it, Kyle? It's like an old factory.
It's an old factory that has been remodeled and basically turned into a shopping complex. But it's interesting because there's a lot of local sort of small businesses, not a lot of chains.
I didn't see any chains other than local chains.
Yeah, it's definitely in the vein of arts and crafts and local flair. And it used to be, I believe, a stove factory where they made all kinds of old stoves of various models and makes. So that was fascinating, just bumping into that. And so there was a coffee roaster there that we wanted to see. A lot of good craft coffee, we noticed. But, of course, it was something we always seek out. It's a great thing to do while you're traveling.
It's a good start. It sort of sets the tone. And if there's a good coffee place, odds are there are other cool things around the neighborhood as well. We spent a lot of time just walking and you know, just exploring. We went to Hattiesburg, Mississippi. That was kind of nice.
We did.
Didn't really explore it that much, but
that had a lot of change. A lot more strip malls and stuff. But weird chains, different chains,
yes,
than what we were used to. This was the point in our trip where I was looking for the famous Eclipse goggles, and there was like a chain called Action Sports. Never ever heard of that at all in my life. But it, just a lot of funny stuff like that you notice. But it's it is the sort of necessary part and active part of people's lives. That's where they go to get things done and go out and be prepared with whatever sport equipment they need. That kind of stuff is something everyone there is used to because it's the closest places to patronize. So.
Pretty much every place we went, there was a cool section to go to and to talk to people and not feel like, you know, you're going back a century or in fear for your life or anything like that. I think that's kind of something that we instill in ourselves. Yeah, there's evil and bad and prejudice and all kinds of things out there.
But there's also a lot of, like, smartphones and, you know, people tapped into all kinds of modern amenities that are not unlikely. And we can maybe forget that on the coasts, but information technology has been very pervasive and is as prevalent there as it is here, which is it's cool. There's a lot of activity.
It's not just the information technology. I mean, yeah, that's a good thing. It's a good sign, but
it's an example.
You know, bad people can use that as well.
Sure.
And they will, and they have. But I just think that the sense that we got is that the country is a lot more woke than we give it credit for sometimes. No, seriously, it's I felt good about it because I see a lot of local actions, and we tend to look at the country on a obviously nationwide scale. But if you go to the communities, if you go and talk to people, you realize that everyone's doing their bit, and they're trying to get through whatever crisis they're facing. And most of the time, even if we disagree with them, most of the time they're good people.
Well,
and lots of times there are people who we do agree with who are in these situations. Imagine being in Mississippi, in Tennessee, in Texas, in Louisiana, and not New York City, not where it's easy. I think it means more when people speak up and stand out. And I saw a lot of that.
Yeah, there's still a huge cross section of American culture. And you can find that pretty much everywhere you go, which it was heartening. It was a lot of cool spirit in all the places we went.
Plus the people on the train that we met. When you go on the train, what happens is you have three meals a day. If you have a sleeper on the train, you get your meals included. And three times a day, you get seated at a table. And if there's two of you, like there were with me and Kyle, you get seated opposite to other people who are complete strangers you've never seen before, and you have a conversation with them. It's not required, but it's unavoidable, really. And unlike an airplane, where I'm the most antisocial person in the world, I will not say a word to the person next to me, usually, for the entire trip. I will start conversations on the train because we're on a train, for God's sake. We're seeing things going by the window as we're sitting there. We're all in this together. We're there for a couple of days sometimes. And you wind up meeting some really, really cool people. We met some people from virtually every state we had traveled to. We met people from Houston, and I hope they're okay in the storm of 500 years they're going through for the third time.
Yeah, that was not even something we were aware of when we were speaking with them. But
couldn't have been. We'd have to be able to see the future.
It was weeks ahead. Yeah, there wasn't even a forecast of a storm, but. Foreshadowing, though, since Houston was indeed in the news this week.
Well, we spent time in New Orleans, and New Orleans is a city that really touches me. I can't really explain why. It just does. There's something about the mood in that place. There's so much tragedy, so much poverty that the city has seen being forgotten so many times. But people there have this spirit of survival. And to see, on the day we were leaving, to see people stacking sandbags again in preparation for what might be another major storm, it was heartbreaking. And, of course, the storm didn't hit them, not directly, but went straight for Texas. And our thoughts and concerns, obviously, are focused on them and the people we met who came from these places. And it's just an incredible set of circumstances to go through all these places, to see these people, to visit different cities and different communities, and come back here and realize that it's all attached. It's all part of the same thing.
I mean, excuse me, I think a lot of what you're talking about here is so important, and we often forget this because we live in New York, and if we're not in New York, we generally live online, and we live online on these sort of social media echo chambers where we see what we want to see, we're fed more of what we like, and we often forget that there are other people with many differing views. And when you force yourself and you expose yourself, and I don't mean that in the obscene sense, of course, but when you expose yourself to these other people, you begin to realize that even though you may have very fundamental differences, even though you may differ politically, religiously, sentimentally from most of the people with whom you were consorting, let's say in Mississippi or New Orleans or anywhere you were in the South, you respect them. You understand their views.
And they respect us, and that's important.
And that's important. And this country was founded on a bedrock of tolerance, of religious tolerance, of political tolerance. And we often forget that these days. We are so polarized, and the political process is so polarizing that we forget that we are not the lowest common denominator of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, that we are fundamentally people. And so I think you're speaking to a really important issue, and it speaks to the importance of getting out there and traveling. And no amount of time that you spend online will ever be a substitute for that.
You know, it's interesting. On the final train we took back, a train called the Cardinal that goes from Chicago, it takes kind of the long way around. There's the Lakeshore Limited, which goes directly from Chicago to New York, and then there's the Cardinal, which goes through D.C. By chance, this was completely unplanned, it stopped in Charlottesville. And as we were going into Charlottesville, I just saw this banner hanging out a window saying, "No room for hate." And that was just the most incredible thing to see things like that out the window and to realize that you're going right through the heart of that community. It was really something else. One thing we did want to talk about that is very specific to what we are focused on this show is the transit systems of the countries, of the cities. Almost, it feels like countries almost. Well,
transit technology.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Transit technology that one day hopefully will come here.
Starting with Orca, but you've got, what do you have
hand
there?
I have cards.
Souvenirs? What are those?
They feel like credit cards. You have the Orca card. That's why I don't have it. Because, you're from Seattle. You have an Orca card that you're still able to use.
Yes.
And you simply put me on your Orca. It's hard to say Orca card for some reason.
Orca card.
Okay, fine. If you're from Seattle, I guess it's easy. But basically, can you describe what that card does?
That card is like a wallet or a thing that I can top up through a web portal.
Okay, it's not like a wallet because you can put things in a wallet. It's like a virtual wallet.
An e-wallet.
Okay,
yes.
E-wallet. It's actually
in their system, as it were, and mm-hmm. you basically can spend from that and coordinate with the entire system, including buses, light rail, regional rail, and so on and so forth, which is pretty massive system. You can also add special rides. I don't know. You paid for things in advance. There are ways you can add special trips if you want. But it's a pretty flexible system. It's contactless, meaning you just wave it in front of a sort of a beacon, similar to contactless payment. Anyway, it activates the gate, checks your balance, and off you go into the system. And it's very clever in so far as calculating what you actually owe, and will allow you to do multiple transfers. But there's ways around it. It's funny because there's little quirks. Like if you have two people and you want to double tap, you can do that in advance for some lines. But the normal mode is, say, for instance, like with the MTA where you swipe and then swipe again for someone else. It's not as easy for the drivers, and often on the buses they'll just wave you past.
Well, what's interesting? Okay, you brought that
functionally,
up.
Functionally, it's weird.
You brought that up with swiping twice on the MetroCard here. There's a bug in the system in New York where if you do that, and then you get on a bus for a transfer, you automatically get two transfers. In other words, the people can't split up. They have to always travel together. And if you have left one of them behind, you're going to get two transfers, and you can't just give one to somebody else.
Yeah, and the another thing that you find with these contactless systems is where exactly you tap out is sort of it's up to you, but there's different strategies around that. And, always tapping out, it doesn't necessarily always serve you. Sometimes you can get charged like two full trips. There's other idiosyncrasies to that you have to pay attention to. Otherwise, you can really charge a lot. I think a driver paid charged me full price at one point because I mentioned that I had already paid for two.
Well, you know, there are supposed to be the Oyster card in London, which I have here. That's a similar system. And that's very smart because what it does is it calculates, figures out what the best pass for you for the day is. If you spend more than a day pass, it'll just give you a day pass for that day. And I think Seattle is similar.
It is, but it doesn't work exactly the same. But it's fundamentally structured the same way. But like I said, there are some subtle differences. I think the Tube Oyster system is a little bit more on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a really interesting system. There's another technology I want to get to, which is just parking, which is another interesting thing. But we've got how many of these cards now?
We've got a few, but let's slow down for a second because I wanted to mention what you said in Seattle.
Sure.
As far as buses, we could not find a single bus driver who knew how to process two people on one card.
Yeah.
So without fail, and folks in Seattle try this, without fail, if you say you have two people, they'll just wave you through. That's literally what they did, because I don't know why it's so difficult. You basically you're supposed to hold the thing in front of the reader. I don't know why you can't just hold the thing in front of the reader a second time, but apparently that's not how it works, and they will wave you through. Either that, or they just don't know how the system works themselves.
Yeah, from my understanding, what it seems like is that it's not that easy. They have to take time to perhaps type in a quantity of adults or something on their keypad,
mm-hmm.
at the, and you know, meanwhile, people are lined up trying to get into the bus. So these are moments that drivers really don't want to be spending with finicky buttons and fiddling around like that. So it's easier, I think, for them to just say, okay, look, you know, you have this guest with you. You're, you know, and maybe they don't recognize you as somebody that's abusing this every day. So they just have that sort of wide latitude to say, well, just get on. We'll get out of here.
You have to have an honest face.
Yeah,
somehow we've managed
it. It helps. We definitely bring the honesty with us.
Now, Alex, you lived in London for a while.
I did indeed.
Did you make use of the Oyster card?
I did almost every single day. Uh-huh. I'm a big fan of the Oyster card, as a matter of fact. I have a friend who actually had his tailor weave into his suits various Oyster cards so that he wouldn't even have to take them out. He could just literally wave his hand over the turnstile and open the door.
Like Jesus.
Just like Jesus.
Wow, because he never paid for transit.
No, well, not that we know of.
He always got a ride somewhere.
None of the
didn't always work out, but he always got a ride somewhere.
That's true.
Maybe you could explain this to me, Alex, because this continue. See, I have the Oyster card in my hand. When you get the Oyster card in London, you pay a deposit, and then when you're done with it, you get your deposit back. Literally, paid for this on a credit card, and I got cash back. I thought that was really cool.
Yes.
But look, I still have the card. I could still keep the card. What was the deposit for?
That I have no idea about.
Everyone
that's
says
that's
the same thing.
Question.
Nobody has any idea.
I've
figured
never done that.
I'd be giving back the card to get my deposit back. But here I have a card that I don't know if it can be used ever again.
They probably deactivated, but I really don't know the answer to it. To go back to it, I think the Oyster card system is really fantastic. It sounds very much like the system in Seattle. And it's great that you can use it on buses pretty seamlessly. I mean, you pretty much have to use an Oyster card on a bus in the transit system now. On a bus specifically, because there's really no way to pay a driver. You can't have a ticket. You know, you need an Oyster card to do that. You can get a single ride if you're just going into the tube, but it is much cheaper, it's much more effective, and there's a lot of incentive
to have. It's
expensive.
A single ride is expensive.
It certainly can be. It can be very expensive, and it's distance-based as well. It's not like New York, where the subway was designed to be this equalizing system that's very egalitarian, that you could come from, you know, the bowels of Queens and go all the way into...
Why the bowels of Queens?
That just came into my
head.
Grew
up in Queens, and...
That was a... Nobody's perfect. So, I'm sorry about that. But, you know, we can talk about that off the air if you want to.
Speaking of nobody being perfect, you know, I grew up only a couple blocks away from where Donald Trump lived as a kid.
That doesn't surprise me either.
I mean, that's just insane. No. And you want to know this, that crazy white supremacist guy from was featured in
Mel Gibson?
Charlottesville.
Oh,
no.
Okay, gotcha.
He lived two blocks away from me on Long Island.
Really?
Yeah, so I don't know what's going on here.
Well,
but,
Suffolk County is a weird place.
There are buzzards circling around. And
yeah.
Anyway, let's get back to mass transit because I think that's a lot cooler.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Rob, you had something.
Well, talking about a lot cooler, I'd just like to say that I live in Queens near where the Ramones are from, so I'm enjoying that. But the thing that strikes me about all these...
You know the fiber optic who used to be on this show used to live in the same building as Joey Ramone. So there you go. That's more right. Coincidences.
Awesome.
I insulted a lot of people tonight.
And I interviewed Joey Ramone once and Johnny Ramone.
Excellent.
May they both rest in peace.
Indeed. The thing that strikes me about these cards, the Oyster card or Kyle's, a Kierkegaard or
Orca
card, yes.
I can't say it, but I can remember it.
These contactless systems are so much more robust. I mean, in New York, we're stuck with these flimsy magnetic stripe Metro cards that every time you use them, they have to be read and rewritten to and read again to confirm the rewriting. And it's just this whole system with so many more points of failure than something you could just use contactlessly. And it, I think the heavy lifting data-wise is done on a remote server.
Well, may you say that, Rob, now, but in the year 2022, you might not say that. And that's what we're getting to, is what's going to happen here in New York in a few years, because what we're looking at, these are other systems that I think do it better, that are more sturdy, that I think just make more sense. And yeah, the flimsy magnetic stripe of our Metro cards will soon be a thing of the past. I remember, you know, back the early days, the first Hope, in fact, 1994, our own Jim was part of this, basically an expose on the Metro card, which was new. It was just coming out. We were very dubious, doubtful that it would ever succeed, that it would be used in bad ways. I think some of that might have come true, but for the most part, the system sort of works. But we all were kind of mourning the eventual loss of the token. And have you guys all used tokens at one point or another?
Oh, yes. Sure. No. Absolutely.
Kyle, you weren't here in time for that, were you?
No.
Yeah. Well, it was a little coin that you would put into the turnstile. And remember those big turnstiles that you would push?
Absolutely.
And, oh, my God.
You still have the token system in Philadelphia.
That's right. Yep. Yeah. Philadelphia, you still have this really old, archaic system. I think you have to buy two tokens, which kind of
right.
sucks if you only want one ride.
That's right.
But anyway, okay, so let's continue moving down the coast here. San Francisco was our next stop, and they have something called the Clipper Card, which also, Kyle, would you say this is the same type of system,
yeah.
contactless?
Yes.
All right. It basically works on the BART system. It works on the Muni system. Muni is basically buses and streetcars in San Francisco. BART goes through Berkeley and Oakland and San Francisco. It's kind of like a LIRR type system. It also works in San Jose, believe it or not, on a completely different system. It's weird because you can't buy a ticket for the BART system and use that same ticket on the Muni system. They're separate, independent, but you can store multiple systems on one card. So if you can wrap your head around that, you're basically having a fare of BART, then you're having a fare of Muni, then you're having a fare of the ferry that you might take from one place to another.
Yeah, it works on boats.
Yeah, it works on a lot of places.
Which I think some of the newer ferries in New York, you also can use your MTA card, but it's exactly like that, except contactless and part of this inter-agency single card system.
Yeah.
Can you hold that card up again? That's an interesting looking card,
too. I'll give
you
the card.
Let me see that. This looks like a door card at a cheap hotel.
This is an interesting technology, and this is a good time for people that have saved these up. If you have a bunch of these, it's time to hack them, to take a look at how they work, what's on them, and share information. Can you imagine one day when you have one card that works on every transit system?
Yeah.
That may be a day that we see with the similarities and the ability for a card like this to work on multiple systems. Could you imagine one that works on an entire tri-state transit network or on the entire West Coast?
Why not just have a card that you have all your expenses, all your travel, everything is on that card. That card is you. And that way everything you do is monitored and tracked for the convenience of the state. Well, I'm just fantasizing. I can dream.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's probably where we're heading. A lot of this, every single one of these things has privacy implications, and there is a site someplace where you can access where has this person gone, and if you're accused of a crime or something like that, it's a great way to gather evidence or even prove your innocence. So it's something that we have to keep in mind.
We also saw the use of apps that can query these cards. I believe that was what you were just speaking to. There's software and ways that they can be interrogated, perhaps even without you knowing.
Mm-hmm.
Literally the balance and anything readable
right.
can be energized from a distance and shared or otherwise scrutinized, which is part of that whole process, the implications.
No, that's some idiot ringing the doorbell downstairs. Max just went running by with one of those things that you cook pasta in, boiling water.
Okay,
we cook pasta in the back, and he's running to the window with it right now. So if you're the person doing that, you don't have long.
Oh my! It sounds like someone trying to start a car.
Oh boy, it's unbelievable. But anyway, yes. So can I just say one thing though? We're in the Bay Area right now. We're talking about Bay Area mass transit, there's good and bad. There's a lot of bad. There's a lot of bad because when you come from New York, you're used to frequent trains. You're used to things that make a degree of sense, even if it is gritty and hot sometimes. It does work. The system does work. But there you find yourself waiting for trains for way too long. There are too few trains or too few stations. And it's, there are just things that somehow don't seem to make sense. And one of the things, I actually have a recording of this right now. For some reason, the BART system has recordings that I think were recorded by Stephen Hawking.
Here,
take a listen to this.
Ten car train for Pittsburgh A flight in 1 minute.
You notice how the voices are different? I think they have three different voices. There's a female version, but I don't think I got that. But that's what you hear, and everyone that's normal. That's because they've been hearing this. It must have been since the 70s they've been hearing that voice.
Mind you,
why don't they update that voice?
This is the epicenter of the high-tech capital, in the Silicon Valley itself, the epicenter, and it's still being run on like a Macintosh or something.
You know, Stephen Hawking could update his voice anytime. He could sound like, you know, the guy that does the AirTrain. But that's his identity. He's keeping that voice. But Bart doesn't have to keep that voice. In fact, it's confusing because you think Steve Hawking is telling you where to go, and that's not right.
So what's the utility of the different voices? Do they like talk to each other or argue? Or?
No, I think actually they just make sure the same voice doesn't go twice for different trains. Hmm. So you might have a different voice announcing your train 5 minutes down the road. It's not one voice attached to one train. So, but you know, it just kind of annoys me because it feels old and antiquated and not maintained. And it's San Francisco, like Kyle said. You know, it's a Silicon Valley area. We can do a lot better than that.
One of my favorite things about Barcelona was very similar. It was the transit system there, the metro. The way in which they announced the stops was I thought, you know, really interesting and sort of funny to me. It was this combination of feminine and masculine voices to announce the next stop on the subway. Mm-hmm. So you'd have the situation where they'd say, you know, basically be saying something like, you know, the next stop is Diagonal. So it would say in a female voice, the next stop is or La Próxima Estación. And then in a very masculine voice, Diagonal. You know, so it was just get a kind of bizarre combination, but uh-huh. I appreciated the sort of yin and yang of it. Or La Próxima Estación, Catalunya. It was really fantastic.
Well, okay, so any more memories from the Bay Area? The fact that it worked in San Jose as well on a different system I thought was really cool. And it works on Caltrain as well, which is their commuter line. But again, way too few trains, you know, and they can do a lot better. They're building more. They're building more lines, but I think they just need to expand.
It's certainly an improvement over the bus network, and it augments it. It definitely helps. With buses, but you really do realize that the frequency of these do matter, and it's tough to argue for not being in a car if both a bus and light rail takes, you know, an hour or two to get from one part of town to another. You have to realize also the cities are very, very spread out mm-hmm. on the West Coast, L.A., and San Francisco. I believe L.A. is next.
Yes, Los Angeles. They have the tap card. It's another credit card type card, contactless. Yep. Works on their expanding metro system, which actually they've been expanding that fairly rapidly, and I'm impressed. Again, they need more, they need to publicize it better. We took a bus all the way out to Santa Monica, and we were looking for the we knew there was a line on the subway that went back to Union Station or in that area, and we couldn't find a sign for it any place. We had to finally just look on the internet to see where the entrance was, and once we got to that entrance, it was great. There was a light rail that went all the way back. But they need more things like that. They need the system to be utilized better.
Yeah, definitely in the vein of advertising, I would say signage is a big thing. There is some of the displays, the LED displays that update and give you pretty good information about when. Did you? I just remembered the odd numbering for minutes till a train arrives in
Bay
Area.
Right, that was the other thing in the Bay Area. It's
very
so
funny.
Weird. They'd say it would be basically next train to what's a destination? I'm trying to think of a believable destination. Fisherman's Wharf. I'm
sure.
Not sure if that's a final destination, but it would say 2:11. And it's like, okay, two minutes and 11 seconds. That's really precise. Why is it so precise? And then it would stay that way. And then you realize that basically what it was doing was it was telling you the next two trains with a comma between them.
Yes.
And it was minutes. So comma, 2 minutes and 11 minutes.
The comma is separating. That's right. And so it took us a while to actually decipher that. And we realized it was used on both multiple generations. In other words, when they upgraded to T TV or monitors that are higher resolution, they kept the same thing, the canonical comma between the two times, which we thought was very interesting, even when you go out to the airport and places where there is a lot more signage. But general, like, basic signs, mm-hmm. I think, are undervalued and could be a lot more deployed and a lot more visible and numerous in numbers as far as just blanketing the system with identifiable stuff.
You know what else got me in the Bay Area system, more unneeded information, was how long the train was.
Yeah.
This is a 7-car train. So not that basically they only have a couple of lines and they're wasting half of it by telling you how long the train is. Doesn't matter how long the train is. The platform will pretty much serve you no matter where it stops. You know, maybe mention that once. It doesn't need to be a main thing. But I have these criticisms for so many things in the local area as well. If you ever take a New Jersey Transit, for instance, from Newark Airport, they tell you the number of the train. Nobody cares about the number of the train other than the person driving it. It doesn't make any difference to the passengers. Buses in New York City, you ever notice they have a number in the front? That's not the route number. It's some other number for internal use only. It's on the lower left. And that's the one that you see before you see the route number. So why do we have to have this information? All kinds of other things the way that information is displayed in the subway system. Who cares when the next L train is? Why would you let the first one go by? You know, you don't need to know the next one is 25 minutes later. Yeah.
The long and the short of it is that the system, once it's in place, it's great that it's all there, and there's a lot of emphasis on actually installing things and getting it right as far as functionally having people pay for things and the ebb and flow of commuters. But definitely information and signage should be an entire department and really have a lot of thought put into it. But in most cases, our experience was that it's like an afterthought, mm-hmm. which isn't so good for people, especially those that aren't everyday commuters, maybe, or a la visitor, somebody who's traveling and completely unfamiliar. Things ought to be more intuitive.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I like systems that make sense, that are intuitive, that you can understand if you're speaking a different language. And that's something we have to work on locally, because a lot of it doesn't make any sense, and there's, you know, stupid things that are emphasized.
Yeah, little exceptions. And, yeah, the details are overlooked in as far as ergonomics and things being intuitive and mm-hmm. logical.
Okay, so New Orleans was our next stop, and there we used an app to get a day pass. And, okay, I've recently started using the app on the Long Island Railroad here. It's very, very similar, and I'm curious how that app works. Maybe one of our listeners has information on the technical aspects of it. In New Orleans, what happens is you get what's known as a Jazzy Pass. That's the day pass, or that's a pass in
general.
It's
the best deal. You got to look out for these things.
It really is.
You want to, you know, explore for just a certain amount of time, or you want a 24-hour pass. Instead of, you know, paying for 4 or 3 individual trips, it costs you an arm and a leg when you mm-hmm. actually do the math. So these are great deals. So we found it and explored, and actually it was really useful.
Well, and it starts, it lasts for 24 hours from when you activate it. So it's not something that just ends at midnight. If you activate it at 9 o'clock at night, it'll last until 9 o'clock at night the next night, whether or not anything is running overnight. And the St. Charles streetcar does run all night, which is kind of cool. But not much else. But what you get when you activate this, you pay for it, and you get an account, and then you click the activate button, and then it says active on your phone.
It's a timestamp or a timer, basically.
Yeah, it's a timer. It tells you how much time is left, but also it gives you a 4-letter word. No, it gives you a 4-letter word that I think one of them was epic.
Yes.
And then the next day that word turned to the word fear.
Or fail.
No, it wasn't
like
fail. I don't think they would use that word. I'm surprised they used fear. But basically what I think happens is you show that to the driver, and they look at it, and they see the word of the day. It's going back and forth, left to right. And they say, okay, that's valid for today. But on the Long Island Railroad, what it does, it has 3 colors. Now, the time goes back and forth. It basically lasts for as long as the ride lasts. So they tell you to activate it before you get on your train, right before you get on your train, and it lasts for, I don't know, a couple hours or whatever. But the thing is, they just, every time I've used this, they just look at it and say, okay, but they're not reading anything. So I don't know if they're actually confirming the three colors change too. If you watch them for 5 minutes, those colors slowly change into three other colors. So it's not like the color for today is red, white, and blue. It's basically three colors that slowly change and a time that bounces back and forth. There is a barcode. You can click read barcode, but no one has ever asked me to do that. So I'm just wondering how secure are these systems as far as confirming the person actually has paid for a fare?
It's likely that people have tried maybe to predict or keep a catalog of what colors or what words, as in the New Orleans system, are used. I know in Seattle, the paper transfers were coded with a letter and a color every single day.
Yes.
And there were people that would keep track of or keep all of their transfers and try to come up with a predictable pattern that's used on the paper transfers. This is very similar, except as you can imagine, it's easier to change. And I think the way the easier to change and update and synchronize, being that it is digital, the conductors too also have smartphones and barcode scanners. Mm-hmm. So what I think is they have a sense, they're given an update or some channel that's in their administrative app that updates them as to what the word or the color of the day is. Not so much, I don't know.
Well, there's no color of the day in the LIRR because it changes.
Well, yeah, you noticed that it was fading, but it's three bands of color. Uh-huh. So I'm not sure if the band moves, it's like animated, and that's a part of the security that animation continues in a predictable way. But you said you noticed a little bit of the color change. This has to be studied more.
Every five minutes, it's slowly like yellows change to green.
I haven't stared at it. I haven't looked at the colors.
But you
changing.
Can only look at it while you have an active ticket. Right. So that's the thing. You have to buy a ticket and then look at it for 2 hours.
That's something new that you noticed. But uh-huh. I definitely I think that's all they're really doing is confirming the date and the time and then that it's some semblance of this color.
I honestly think they're confirming the date and time, and that's basically the whole thing. So I don't think it would be very difficult to fake this app and get free rides.
Well, let me ask you this. What happens if you have a conductor who's colorblind?
Well, that's the thing. I don't think they're looking at the color. I think they're just looking at the date bouncing back and forth.
Maybe they're not looking at anything. They just wave you through.
Well,
maybe they're moving.
They look you in the eye for about 30 seconds. It's scary. They always do that. It's kind of like that Larry David thing where they looks you up and down. And they can tell if you're lying. So LIRR conductors, don't mess with them.
I agree with that.
Our final city, Chicago, where they have a pass known as the Ventra Pass. And Alex, I know you took Latin. What does Ventra mean?
Ventra?
Ventra. Allegedly, because it might not mean that.
I don't. Off the top of my head, I'm not sure. Okay. Ventra. V-E-N-T-R-A.
Yes.
Couldn't tell you off the top of my head. Ventra. I mean, it could have something to do with the wind, but
yes,
I don't think so.
Yes, you got it. Yes. Windy.
Okay,
it's supposed to be windy. The windy city.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The Ventra card.
Yes.
The windy card, yeah.
But we didn't get a Ventra card. We got a little paper pass that was apparently good for the entire day. Now, the interesting thing about Chicago is it's run by Cubic. Cubic makes the MetroCard system, same basic system as New York.
Uh-huh.
So what they are doing is likely the kind of thing that we will be doing in the future.
Which is retrofitting that very system with the contactless system, basically removing the magstripe parts of it and adding this RFID system.
Starting in 2019, the MTA here in New York is planning to start superseding the MetroCard with a new form of fare payment technology. Now, basically, the MTA is saying that MetroCard remains too expensive to maintain. Their latest capital budget report, they estimate that the total cost of overhauling the system will be around $500 million. Now, they want to switch over to an electronic system that would get rid of the need for separate cards, a new fare payment system based on a form of technology for payment, which is technically known as RFID or NFC for near-field communication type of payment. It's really common in Europe. You can pay for taxis with it. Hasn't gotten as much traction here, but it has overseas. So that's your first key right there that it's going to catch on eventually. I remember doing a show from overseas where I was telling people about text messages, which nobody here was doing, but over there it was a big thing. So, yeah, that's going to be a big thing here as well. Now, what we noticed in Chicago was that you could load your fare onto a contactless credit card or bank card if you wished. I didn't happen to have any of those.
Yeah, we were noticing signage that encouraged you to use this technique, which is really interesting. I guess it's a built-in part of the specification with contactless credit cards, where you can actually load a portion of that memory for that particular chip and use it with the system.
Uh-huh.
I remember them trying out some contactless thing here in New York, maybe a couple of years ago, 2-3 years ago, and I don't recall if it was to work with these cards or some other RFID type thing that they would give you.
That was part of the 6-month trial that they had?
I think so.
Yeah, okay. Well, hopefully that was successful, because the plan is to have this done by 2022. And basically, and instead of swiping a magnetic metro card, you would tap a credit card, you tap a smartphone, or a keychain. Anything that has that particular chip embedded in it, and just goes straight through. It seems like they're almost skipping this this whole credit card thing and just giving you the info that you put on your credit card.
In fact, I have one of these contactless cards in my hand right now.
I
can snap things on the table too.
How about that? But it's different than it's got the chip in it, but the chip isn't what does the magic. It's got the mag stripe. That's not what does the magic.
Yeah, there's some sort of magic in
here
somewhere.
You've got so many things in that credit card.
It really is. Yeah, this is one of my cards from London, as a matter of fact, and you could use this for the tube as well. As long as you connected it to your Oyster card account, you just swipe that over and you're all set.
It sounds complicated, and it is complicated, but once you start using it, you get the hang of it.
Well, this is really convenient, too. I mean, aside from connecting it to your Oyster card, but the contactless cards become really convenient if you're at a pub, you don't want to take out cash, and you don't want to slow the bartender down by having to swipe a card, do the whole thing, put it in. He just brings the machine over, you literally tap, and you pay for your round of drinks in, you know, literally milliseconds. It's very convenient.
Yes. And we've seen this in science fiction shows in the past. And
yes.
Now we're finally catching up to them.
So it's a great time to be alive.
It is. Well, in some ways it is. Okay, but that's pretty much our documentary on various transit systems.
But don't be surprised if there's an uptick in exploitation of these. If everyone is using them, what do you have? You have a ton of people that could be potential targets to have their anything from their balance swiped to cloning and on and on, maybe keeping tracking you. There's a myriad of things that come to the imagination when you really start thinking about this system once it's in place functionally.
Yes. If you have information or questions you'd like to send to us, our email address, oth@2600.com. We'd love to hear from you. There are other things going on in the world. Alex, I think you'll get a kick out of this. An alleged Russian hacking group has been permanently banned from hacking Microsoft computers or using their trademarks after Microsoft won a major U.S. court victory. And now the tech giant is legally entitled to command and control the hackers' domains.
Fantastic.
But I don't understand why they have to go to court to tell people not to hack their systems. That seems a little bizarre. On Tuesday, U.S. District Judge Gerald Bruce Lee ruled in favor of Microsoft in a lawsuit against a hacking group known as Fancy Bears.
Mm-hmm.
You can't make this up.
That's right. APT-28.
APT-28 and Strontium.
Mm-hmm.
They have different names. Just to confuse everybody. In the ruling, the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia permanently enjoined Fancy Bears from sending malicious software or code to infect Microsoft or Microsoft's customers without authorization. Again, does that mean we can? Because we're not Fancy Bears, at least not that I know of?
Not necessarily. I think you would probably still suffer the consequences of a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
So why did they, as a lawyer, why did they take this to court just to tell them they can't do something that's already illegal?
Well, it is kind of bizarre to me. Without seeing what the actual filings were, it's difficult to say why they did this, but they received an injunction. They were awarded an injunction from this federal district court judge who has an amazing name. And that means that, look, if they violate the injunction, then they can be held in contempt. So perhaps maybe Microsoft knows where some of the assets are.
Well, interesting you should say that. Under the order, Microsoft was granted the ability to take over command and control domains the hackers used to manipulate malware installed on victim computers. Now, through the lawsuit, Microsoft has been able to take over at least 70 different command and control points from the hacking group since August. Instead of taking control of physical servers, Microsoft has been taking control of the internet domain names that route the servers Fancy Bears rent from data centers. Microsoft has taken over domain names such as MicrosoftInfo365.com and LiveMicrosoft.net, which the company can use to observe the hackers' activity and stop them from controlling infected computers. So well, I think that's what this court case allows them to do.
That actually is very interesting, too, that they filed this in federal district court. I guess they wanted to get the injunction for some particular reason, because there's a much faster and much more economical way to take control of those domain names. It's called the UDRP process, which is a little bit of a misnomer. And we've discussed this before on the show, but it stands for the Uniform Domain Name Dispute Resolution Policy. And if somebody is infringing on a trademark or perhaps a name, like this Shkreli character did this week with journalists, where he was registering the domain names of journalists to essentially harass them, if somebody is infringing on a commonly used name, a famous name, a well-known trademark, and if the domain names at issue had the trademark Microsoft in them, and it seems like they did, then Microsoft could have pursued a UDRP action, which is a little mini arbitration that happens on the papers. Generally, the respondent doesn't respond, and it all happens in a matter of weeks. And it's incredibly economical to file these things. We do them all the time, and our fees usually range between, you know, $4,000 and $10,000, depending upon how complex the case is, whether there's multiple respondents, et cetera, that require the collection of different evidence. But Microsoft, for some reason, wanted to go to federal district court, probably to get this injunction, perhaps because they know where some of the assets are, such that they could go after them if this injunction is violated. It's also a bit more of a show of force to go into federal district court and make these claims and put them on the record as opposed to what you would put into a UDRP. So it's an interesting way to take control of a domain name.
Wow. You know, I have to say, 9 out of 10 of the stories that we've been getting lately have to do with this whole stupid Game of Thrones hack of HBO and how HBO is being held hostage by a bunch of evil hackers someplace who are threatening to leak episodes and scripts and things like that. Does anybody else realize that this is tremendous publicity for both the show and the network? And I don't know a single person who has canceled their HBO subscription or hasn't gotten the show the way they normally do just because somebody somewhere got an advanced copy of it. So it's, you know, I think it's a real win for them. But the latest story is that, well, at least the story before they aired the finale was that HBO was holding firm and not paying, what was it that they wanted? $6.5 million before it was reported that they had changed something they had paid something, rather. And I guess they decided not to do that again. But basically, they said, we are not in communication with the hacker. We're not going to comment every time a new threat is issued or a new piece of information is released. It's been widely reported there was a cyber incident at HBO. The hacker may continue to drop bits and pieces of stolen information in an attempt to generate media attention. That's a game we're not going to participate in. Well, you are HBO, so I think you are participating in that game just by having this stuff available in the first place and basically having this scandal, this quote-unquote scandal, taking place and dominating the headlines for so long.
I agree, and I think there was a little bit of a back and forth between HBO and these alleged hackers or criminals that had stolen the data. And then that seemed to be some sort of a ruse, and they lowballed them with some, I think it was like a $250,000 offer to shut this down, and they balked at that. So there's been some back and forth, but it seems like HBO just wants to turn the spigot off in terms of the media attention that they're getting from this.
Well,
this
the
point.
Episode has aired, so I don't know if they need any off the attention. I mean, any attention is good attention for
them.
Well,
now the next one is Curb Your Enthusiasm, I guess, to go back to the Larry David reference that's coming up.
Oh, boy. Okay, well, you know, whatever. A quarter of the members of the National Infrastructure Advisory Council, whose purview includes national cybersecurity, have resigned in a group resignation letter that, as far as I know, doesn't spell out anything cool. Like, you know, some of them spell out resign or resist or things like that in the first letter of every paragraph. This one, not that I know of. But they cited both specific shortfalls in the administration's approach to cybersecurity and broader concerns that Trump and his administration have undermined the moral infrastructure of the U.S. The resignations came on Monday. They were acknowledged by the White House on Tuesday. And several of those resigning were Obama-era appointees, including former U.S. Chief Data Scientist Patel and former Office of Science and Technology Policy Chief of Staff Kristen Dorgulow. Not surprisingly, then, The issues outlined in the resignation letter were broad, faulting both Trump's decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accords and his inflammatory statements after the Charlottesville attacks, some of which came during what was intended to be an infrastructure-focused event. "The moral infrastructure of our nation is the foundation on which our physical infrastructure is built," said the letter. "The administration's actions undermine that foundation." You know, I think it's it says a lot when groups, organizations, committees refuse to participate, to coordinate with somebody that they object to. You might say that if you're a part of this, if you're close to the person, you might be able to make them change. It hasn't worked so far. So I think maybe this is the best approach.
Maybe. I mean, I think this is a bit of a double-edged sword as well. Because we need good people in government, and sometimes you can do more good from within than from without. And I understand they're making a political statement by resigning and withdrawing, but I wonder if they could have done more good if they stayed in their current positions. I mean, as you know, and as probably many of our listeners know, I've spent quite a few years in federal agencies myself, places where I didn't think that I would have necessarily ended up as a 15-year-old hacker. But I do honestly believe that there is great good to be done by good people within government. I mean, ultimately, I left government, but it wasn't on the basis of a resistance or anything like that. I see it both ways here. I really do. And I think that they have very legitimate gripes, and I think a lot of these people were Obama holdovers as well. And the fact that they're resigning means that they've been marginalized, that their voices aren't being heard, and there's really critical issues. I mean, I read this article as well, and they spelled out some really major concerns. I mean, things like the sound advice to avoid a quote-unquote cyber 9/11 just was not being listened to. And this raises the question that one of our good friends of this show, Lorenzo Franceschi Bicchieri, the reporter over at Motherboard, raised when Giuliani was appointed to this bizarre position of being some kind of cybersecurity advisor. Where is he? What has he been doing? To whom has Trump been listening from time to time, if at all, when it comes to, quote unquote, the cyber, as he refers to it?
Yeah, I can really give them the benefit of the doubt on this, because here we are. We're 8-9 months into this administration. These people have had time to do what they could to, I guess, work within the system to try and affect change from within. And what they were finding was they were not being granted the opportunity to do that. And I think by resigning like this publicly and making their concerns known, I think that's a very effective. It's almost like a sort of whistleblowing, really, except their actual identities are attached to it. But had they done this as a whistleblowing operation secretly, I think they would have been up for all sorts of punishments and things. So I think this is really the best way they had available to them to accomplish what they wanted to do. And it's a brave move, and it's something that I think is laudable. But at the same time, yeah, I don't think they came by this decision lightly.
I mean, I think this is a story that deserves a lot more specifics. It would be great to talk to some of these people to really understand where they're coming from, what concerns specifically weren't addressed, and what they plan on doing next.
Well, perhaps since they have more time in their hands, they can come on the show and we can ask them these questions directly.
That'd be wonderful.
You know, at some point, though, you know, no matter how much you think you can affect change, don't you agree, Alex, that it becomes pointless, and you have to basically either be a collaborator with them or somebody working actively to prevent this from continuing?
Yeah, I agree. Look, everything comes to a point. There's everything is to an extent, right? And you have to work at it. And, you know, I'd love to understand what they did. What were their actions inside that were ignored? And did that justify their departure? You know, I'd love to know more specifics about this case. I think you're absolutely right. There comes a point when it does become fruitless. And the best thing for you to do if you can't do your job effectively is not do it at all.
All right. And with that, we're going to end things for tonight. If you want to write to us, oth@2600.com is our email address. Rob, this looks like you have something to say.
Yep, check out your local 2600 meeting this Friday all over the world, 2600.com/meetings.
Yeah, special shout out to the Houston meeting. Hopefully, don't risk your lives to get to the meeting, folks, but we're thinking of you, and hopefully you guys get through this okay. Everyone else, as Rob said, meetings this week, and we'll be back again next week. Write to us, oth@2600.com. Follow us, Hacker Radio Show, on Twitter. Good night.
mamacita. Testing 1, 2, 3. Word.
Check this out. This is Chuck, your public enemy number one, the rebel without a pause, bringing the noise and fighting the power right here to the Sights and Sounds. That's right, Sights 99.5 WBAI.
Today is August the 30th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, and we are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, and the program is live stream, and both are available on at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. The live stream is on WBAI.org. Podcasts of this program and other programs of the Personal Computer Show are available on PRN.FM and WBAI.org and our website, PCRadioshow.org. When WBAI is in a membership drive, a replacement program may be scheduled, but the regular program will always continue to be available each Wednesday on PRN.FM. And we have a live guest tonight, and her name is Dr. Rebecca Mercury, and we'll have her on in a few minutes after I cover some of the important news items that occurred in the past week. You know, 3D printing is real technology. It is disruptive technology, but there are three factors in there: cost, size, and strength of material. Well, cost has come down. Size, well, they started off small. You can now have a 3D print of quite large industrial size at much higher cost. They're related with each other, cost and size. But the big thing that's been holding it back is strength of material. It's all plastic. Well, a company by the name of Markforged has come up with two new printers that uses carbon fiber-infused nylon that is as strong as steel. It is 20 times stronger than plastic and 10 times stiffer. So hopefully with this, in due time, it will get into the consumer area itself. And that's one of the things that I think we've been hoping for. Another item is that the FTC has been investigating a company, and they found that the company was scamming the computer users. and they were operating under the name of Advanced Tech Support, and another name was Inbound Core Experts, and they were selling them. They were selling to consumers bogus security software, and there's a settlement of $10 million. The FTC originally sought $120 million, probably was somewhat inflated. Maybe the true amount was maybe closer to $60 million. And they settled for $10 million. And what they're saying is that if you've been one of those victims, contact the FTC. And that represents something like, in terms of real money, somewhere between, maybe 8 cents on the dollar or 16 cents on the dollar. And if you don't respond, the FTC does not keep the money. The pot just becomes available to whoever does respond. So the amount may get larger than that. So if you've been a victim of Advanced Tech Support or Inbound Core Experts, get in touch with the FTC on that. And finally, one other item I have is that I must say that I'm a T-Mobile user, but one of the big items that T-Mobile announced was they're going to be building out low-band wireless network in the rural areas, and they're going to be rolling out some new technology using 600 megahertz LTE. And I was kind of surprised by this because the FCC said they have 2 years to complete this rollout to all the rural areas, and T-Mobile says 2 years? No, we're going to do it in 6 months. That's very ambitious. And what it is that they are using a new modem that was developed by Qualcomm. It's called the X20 LTE modem, and that will help them install some of the equipment in more advanced equipment. The only thing that I'm a little concerned about is that they are working with public television in terms of public access, and they'll be using some of the towers or taking over some of the towers, probably because some of the public access stations just can't make it because they are lacking funding. And the reason why they lack funding is because when they negotiated the contracts with the cable companies, it was done by the municipalities. That means the money is filtered through the municipalities, or what they call the city fathers or the town fathers, before they get the actual funding to continue an operation. Unfortunately, public access television, which is very important, is no longer available in 10 states, and the number of other states are with monetary poverty, I guess, it's growing, and I hope we can stop that. But let me get to our guest tonight. We have Dr. Rebecca Mercury. She's been referred to as one of the leading international experts on electronic voting, and she has a doctoral dissertation, Electronic Vote Tabulation, Checks and Balances. And she comes from, she did that at the engineering school of UPenn. And, hey, Rebecca, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Listen, I understand now you're teaching. What are you teaching?
Yes, I'm actually up here at Drew University in northern New Jersey, in Madison, New Jersey. I'm speaking to you from my office here. And I'm teaching computer science, and we're working on developing a cybersecurity minor.
Oh, gee, that's great. And we've had you on the air in the past, and I hope we get you on a more regular basis. The primaries are coming up in September, and I think, I'm going to ask you a big macro question. How accurate will the vote count be with the primaries?
Well, that's the interesting thing. We really don't know, because they don't do there's nothing, New Jersey especially, where I'm at. It's almost all electronic voting, and there's no way to do a recount from the electronic, so you just have to accept what came out of the computers, and the only thing you can recount is the absentee ballots. And in my county where I live in Mercer County, New Jersey, the election supervisor, she's having a big push on to try to get more people voting as absentee, because that is the only way we can accurately count the votes. So, other counties may do the same. Many states went to electronic, and they found it to be foolhardy, and then they did go to paper. So New York, I believe, uses paper. And, that does provide the opportunity to do a recount, but then some states, including Florida, that went to paper, they actually created laws that make it illegal to count the paper. So it's nice to have the paper, but not if you can't count it. Michigan also, that came up in the presidential election. So people didn't realize that, oh, we can't count those paper ballots. So
let me ask you a simple question. In New Jersey, I know in New York, in the city, we have these scanners. Of course, you fill out the paper ballot, and then the scanner scans them in. But other counties in New York State don't necessarily use a scanner. So in New Jersey, is it all the counties are using the same machine, or different kinds of technologies are implemented?
Well, pretty much they had all gone with this one machine, the Sequoias, which are totally outmoded. You remember the days of the Z80 microprocessor. That's what they're using in there. I mean, it's not a Pentium. It's not a, you know.
Wait a minute. Z80? You mean they
Z80,
have?
Z80, I am not kidding you. Yes, Z80.
You mean they have to go to the junkyards to get the CPU?
I think it's still manufactured, but it's manufactured overseas. So, you know, any types of, you know, code that could compromise it could be developed right into the microprocessor. But not only that, you're going to love this. So Princeton University and the computer science department there, they've been hacking into these vending machines for years. We actually, I say we because I also, a bunch of us bought them at auction when the other states were saying, we're not going to use these. So they were selling them at auction, you know, for like $50, $60. I mean, a whole voting machine, you know, you just have to pay for the shipment to get them, in, you know, up here. So they were, the Princeton University professors, they were hacking into all sorts of voting machines. And you would think, and they published papers on it and testified in court, including in New Jersey and everything. You would think that the state would be, you know, they would be wise enough not to put voting machines. They actually have voting machines, the real voting machines that are used in elections. They have them sitting there in the actual computer science building, just sitting there prior to the elections. I mean, they could have picked, why did they pick the physics building? But, I mean, it's like, hello, are you asking for trouble? So they're just sitting out there. I was astonished to see them there, just these voting machines just sitting out. At least in Pennsylvania, they also use the electronics. So, again, there's no way to do an independent count. But they at least have a sticker on them saying that it's a felony to tamper with them. But not in New Jersey. There's no stickers on them at all. They're just sitting out there right in the front lobby of the computer science building, already there for people to hack into.
Well, when you say electronic voting machines, it's not just one kind. It's different kinds, though, right?
There are different kinds. There's the touch screen kind, which was really notoriously problematic, but many places are still using them. And but some of the places like Maryland that did buy them, and also Florida, they just found them so problematic that they got rid of them and went to the paper. But New Jersey, and I think maybe some of the places in New York, they have a kind of, it's a whole panel of push buttons. You know, but still, it's just covered over by a piece of paper with the names of the candidates. You could shift that over, and then you'd be pushing for the wrong button. So there's a lot of ways that you can defeat, you know, the accuracy of the vote before you even, you know, get even to the tallying part. You can, you know, you can misalign it. There's all sorts of things you can do.
Well, let's not use the word fraud, but you're saying that there could be a great deal of election inaccuracies. No one really knows what it is. If, from a gut feel point of view, do you think it made a difference at all in the presidential election?
Well, again, we have no real way of knowing. But what we do know is that there were some states that, you know, that people did want to try to do a recount, but they couldn't. There was no way to do it. And, you know, we just don't know. I mean, there really isn't a procedure in place when an election is close or there's some disputed facts about it. They don't do a comprehensive type of audit of the type that would be, you know, considered scientifically or mathematically sound. But they, you know, they have their own type of audit, but it's not really as scientific as it needs to be.
Well, let me ask you a question that probably it's in the news media and they don't know any better than anyone else, which is, what did the Russians do or didn't do?
Well, we know that, you know, we have it on good authority from, you know, from federal investigation bureaus and that sort of thing, that the Russians actually